everyone, and welcome to the American Israelite Newspaper Podcast. This is the Let There Be Light Podcast, and I am one of your co-hosts, Netanel Ted Deutsch, and I'm here with my other co-host,
Julie Babs Bernson Brook, who could also be Julie Babs Bernson Chafkin.
Okay, but we call you, you have a new name now here at the paper. It's called Blabber.
Blabber, okay.
Because you're always blabbering on.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm really happy to be back. You know, first I was in Chicago doing an emergency.
That's right. You've been gone.
I was an emergency babysitter. I had a lot of fun.
Emergency babysitter.
And then I actually was in Cleveland yesterday all day. I drove up in the morning to visit my aunt, Mickey Brook.
Did you stop at any place kosher?
I didn't stop at Irv's kosher. Yeah, I didn't stop at anywhere kosher.
Boris's kosher. You could have got me a bunch of rib steaks when you were there.
I could have, but we didn't do anything kosher. But I'll tell you, we walked into Nordstrom, and it was like the Sister Act movie where the nuns come out and they start screaming, "Hallelujah, hallelujah." I swear, my aunt walked in there, and she's like, "Hallelujah, it's been over a year since I've been here."
Now, this is the Nordstrom's. It's like on Green Road.
I guess so. It's in Cleveland.
It's right down the street from Boris. All the synagogues are like right near there.
Yeah.
Boris's kosher, Tibor's kosher meats and all that.
Well, we didn't go.
That's like kosher Cleveland there.
Yeah, we didn't hit kosher Cleveland.
And the hospital's right there. Cleveland Clinic's right down the street from there. Yeah, yeah.
Well, we were mostly at Nordstrom's, Anthropology, Lululemon, Barnes & Noble.
Spending your paycheck that you got from here,
Thank you very much for your generosity. But we really, it was nice. It was nice for her. She had not been to a mall in over a year.
And right down the street, if you turn right on the, I don't know what street it is, because I go there when I go fishing, and I go stop there, and when I come back, I go there. But the Maltz Jewish Museum is like right down the street from there.
If I go back up again and have more time, we'll do more fun things.
That's like the heart of Jewish Cleveland.
I had actually went to see her right before everything closed down. And then the next week, everything closed down. So I was really happy. That was right around our birthday. Yeah, and she was sick, and she had just lost her husband, Barry's uncle Marvin, in January. So it was really, you know, last year when I saw her, it was like a visit after the funeral. Now it was over a year since I had seen her, but I talked to her, and we had a really wonderful time. But I do want to talk about going back two weeks. From May 26th when we had the incredible Mr. Alan Weiner on with his great stories and anecdotes. And did you know that we had a really nice bump in our social media because of our interview with Alan Weiner? But in the meantime, which is a big compliment to Alan Weiner, in the meantime, I like to listen to the podcasts all the time and see how we're doing and where I can improve and where I've made mistakes. So I caught myself saying something that I'd like to talk about. When you were talking, we were talking about the protests, the Palestinians protests, and you had said that you had seen someone on the corner of Montgomery Road.
Stephanie saw somebody.
And Kincaid holding a Free Palestine sign.
Right.
And then I said, whoa. So I want to explain, I'm a full believer in First Amendment rights, which I'm sure you are too.
Right.
So I want to make sure that whoa is not taken as I didn't agree that he should be out there with a sign. I mean, I think you and I both agree First Amendment rights are what
as long
you,
as people he, don't get violent.
Right.
We don't have a problem with peaceful protest.
Right.
And you can come protest here at the Israelite if you want.
As long as you're peaceful, you don't incite violence, and you don't come and try and hurt anybody. So I just want to make sure that I was a little disappointed
that I responded with whoa.
I shouldn't have said whoa. I should have said oh.
Okay.
That is now corrected. That is now corrected.
But we need to also set up today. We have a big day today.
But also I want to go back last week when you had Pam as your co-host.
Yeah.
You and her were talking about page 18 with Samuel Brewer from 1854, talking about the cemeteries. And you and the two of you asked, well, where is Samuel Brewer buried? So I had a little chuckle because if you remember, this is one of the, we talked in the very beginning. So he is buried at the Walnut Hills Cemetery.
Okay.
And you also forgot that in November of last year, 2020, I wrote a whole article about how he is the great-great-great-grandfather of Trip Wolf.
Well, so, and his name is Trip because he's triple.
I'm a triple too.
But
right.
I don't go by Trip. And so's somebody that we'll bring up today. But, you know, I have like a memory deficiency.
Yeah.
It's because I take like a a memory supplement. I don't take a memory supplement. I take a fish oil tablet, which isn't a memory supplement. So, I mean, I need to start taking a memory supplement.
Oh, I had to laugh. So, anyway, but you know, when we have David Harris on here, he's going to help us a lot with our memory and talking about the 200th anniversary of the cemeteries and Chestnut Street.
My whole family's there. We have a plot there that's been there for hundreds of years.
So, and then you also talked about...
No, I made another screw up. Another mistake.
No, it wasn't a mistake. You were talking about Thanksgiving, and you said that your friend, Fred Lazarus, talks about his father.
I was off by a little bit. It was a Lazarus thing.
Okay, so here's the story. Okay, here's the story behind the story.
The
history is that Abraham Lincoln actually began Thanksgiving. But it was not the week it is now. So now it's the third week of November. Back then, it was either the fourth or the second week of November.
Okay.
And so you are correct. What happened during the Roosevelt administration, Mr. Lazarus, who was involved with Macy,
Federated Department stores.
You're 100%.
Lazarus,
so he actually got organized in Ohio, and then they petitioned President Roosevelt to change it to...
I think he went and met with President Roosevelt.
Right, so he changed it to the third week. It was the fourth week, and they changed it to the third week because then they had close to 30 shopping days instead of 24 shopping days.
I play golf with one of my good buddies is Bill Lazarus, who's a descendant of the Lazarus family. And he brought that up with me.
It was actually talked about in the Cincinnati Inquirer. So you can find out, read more about it in the Cincinnati Inquirer. Cool. So I wanted to verify that, yes, that it's true. It's not just a story. So anyway, today is Wednesday, June 9th, 2021, and it is the 29th of Sivan, 5781. And we have a big interview today. We are interviewing Alan Cooperman.
Right.
He is the researcher from the Pew Research Center.
So everybody has heard about the Pew Research Study. About
the American Jews in 2020.
Right. And for Julie, I have to give it to you, Julie. You get a pat on the back for that. Blabs. Pat yourself on the back, Blabs.
Thank you.
Because you went to the... We went directly to Pew.
I called directly to Pew and asked if they had...
You don't have any, like, filters, like, I'm afraid to call somebody. You just go right for it.
You know what I mean? When I was involved with the Democratic Party, they said the same thing. Like, you just don't...
What's there to be afraid of?
Right, everyone pulls their pants on the same way.
Right. So you called up Pew and got a hold of them.
I got a hold of an Anna Schiller.
This is the actual guy that did the survey.
So Alan Cooperman is the director of religion research at Pew Research Center. He's an expert on religion's role in U.S. politics and has reported on religion in Russia, the Middle East, and Europe. He plays a central role in planning the project's research agenda and writing its reports. And before joining Pew Research Center, he was a national reporter and editor at the Washington Post and a foreign correspondent for the Associated Press and the U.S. News and World Report. He graduated magna cum laude from Harvard University in 1982.
Oh, wow. And she's 2 years younger than me, so he'd be 61.
Right. Okay. And he started in journalism at the Berkshire Eagle in Pittsford, Massachusetts. He's the author of Mormons in America, Muslim Americans, the U.S. Religious Knowledge Survey, Nuns on the Rise, which is not N-U-N, it's none, N-O-N-E-S. That's what they're calling people who are Jewish but say they don't have a religious affiliation.
Now, is he Jewish?
I'm assuming his, but we can't
Cooperman,
make assumptions.
Because I knew some Coopermans. There was Coopers.
There are Coopers in
Coopers,
town.
But there's also...
feel free to ask him that when we
Cooperman,
have him on.
I think Cooperman is a Jewish name.
I would say his dad is probably at least, but maybe. Okay. And he also wrote A Portrait of Jewish Americans. He was also the primary editor of Global Christianity and Global Restrictions on Religion.
Where'd he grow up?
He has appeared on numerous media outlets, including NPR, BBC, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, The NewsHour, NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN, Fox, MSNBC, and C-SPAN.
So I think it's interesting that people, when they're younger and they kind of have these expectations, or like he's a high achiever.
Very high achiever.
And he's kind of, he's lived up to the expectations of being a high achiever.
Correct.
Definitely have to say that.
And he worked on this study with Becca A. Alper, and she's also a senior researcher at Pew Research. And she has a doctorate and a master's degree in sociology from Purdue University. Okay. But in the meantime, I'm also going to talk a little bit about this study. So it was funded right. by the Pew Research Center.
Right.
It was also funded by the Jewish Federations of North America, and it was funded by the Neubauer Family Foundation. So the Neubauer Family Foundation was started by Joseph Neubauer and his wife Jeanette Lerman Neubauer, and it's the donors, they donate to the Neubauer Family Collegium for Culture and Society at the University of Chicago, as well as the Pew Research Center. But in the meantime, so Pew Research actually started out as the Times Mirror Company, and then in 1996 it was renamed the Pew Charitable Trust when Pew became its primary funder. And Pew was started by John Howard Pew, who his father was Joseph Newton Pew Sr., who had started an oil business called Sun Oil Company, and today it's known as Sunoco.
Sunoco. Yeah.
And so he was raised Presbyterian. So I always thought, well, maybe the Pews were Jewish, because we always... But Pew does studies on all religions and all people.
Pew. I don't know if anybody ever heard of any Jewish Pews.
So when Mr. Cooperman calls us, we will then break over to talk about more about the study. But in the meantime,
but just to give him a little background on who we're talking to, so that and who he is, and what we're going to be discussing today.
Right. So you know, there was a study in 2013 that was done, and they're having some issues comparing the two because 2013 was done by telephone. But now, because of all the telemarketing, nobody's answering their phone, and most people use their cell phone primarily, and they have their, if you still have a house phone, I still have a house phone, you probably still have a house
phone.
No. No house phone, I still have a house phone. I like my house phone.
No, I don't have, because, and it's real interesting because I remember when I had like maybe a cell phone back in 10 years ago, and I got rid of my phone and just went a cell phone. And people were like asking me, are you going to keep your? And I said, no, I'm not. I'm just going to go with a cell phone. And that was like the trend.
Yeah.
And now that is the trend. Yeah. Everybody has a cell phone. There's not that many people with landlines anymore.
Right.
But, you know, some people still have landlines.
Yeah. No, I like it. Well, first of all, it used to be when your electricity went out, you still had the landline.
Okay.
Now the landline is going through the same system as your internet. So when the electricity goes down, your landline may go down as well. Know.
All right, so one of the interesting things is how do they get to these numbers? And I think it's kind of the same kind of statistical analysis that they used when they did the thing for Cincinnati.
Yeah, they funded, I believe, by the Mayerson Foundation,
So Pam worked on that. Okay, so how they do it is, and I could be wrong, I just we'll find this out. They have like a list of 1,200 people. So all the different synagogues and organizations in Cincinnati send them into a central point, and no one from those central point that they're out sending them in, they're, no one's allowed to know about who is on the list, okay? So that no one's allowed to bias anybody, no one's allowed to steal the list, no one's allowed to get a hold of the list. It all goes to one place. And then when they have that number, all those lists and those people and that and the number, they make a educated statistical guess as to how many they're going to, like, they'll call 1,200 names on the list. And then they ask them if anybody identifies as Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the next step. First,
so that's
they make
how
the
Cincinnati,
call, right,
yeah.
They make the call, then they say, does anybody in the household identify as Jewish? Yes, somebody does.
Okay, and so Pew did theirs a little bit different.
They
randomly selected residential addresses from the U.S. Postal Service and computerized lists and then mailed letters to people across the country asking them a short survey. That survey was what they called their screener.
Okay.
It contained 25 questions, including a few about religion and other elements of Jewish identity. And they also had some... And then they went further and further and further
and deeper, and they did have some financial
incentives, and they were particularly concerned about how they would reach the Orthodox, because not all of them, since the answers were done by both paper and pencil and internet, a lot of the Orthodox do not use the internet in the same way.
Right.
So they had some other incentives to reach them.
Okay. All right, so then once they get that, then they do their survey. And they multiply, it's like they extrapolate. So extrapolating is if 500 people say this, then we are going to multiply that by a specific number and extrapolate from those that statistical analysis that 30,000 people would say the same thing.
Right.
Okay, so that you have to, there's a leap of faith right there that you have to understand when you're doing that kind of statistical analysis.
Correct.
And he'll explain that, I'm sure.
Right.
But that's that, there's a leap of faith in there that if you have X amount of people that do it, then they multiply it and you get, you know, the numbers. These are how they get their numbers.
Well, what we have from them is that they actually, the unweighted sample size was 4,718 people with a margin of error, a 95% margin of error. So they were
that's
maybe off
high.
By, that's, no, no, that's, that was.
It's only 5%.
Yeah, less than, so it's like.
95% correct.
Mostly,
versus
yeah.
5%
and actually, they're
error.
Thinking it was actually 3% correct. They're thinking
okay.
closer. The
okay.
average,
okay.
yeah.
All right.
The average was 95%
okay.
that they were comfortable with. And so it's for all the Jews, they think they're at 3%, but
okay.
say, but the Jews of no religion, they were all the way up to 7%.
Okay,
so
you have to kind of throw that in. It,
right.
It's like, the, okay, okay.
And so that's how they did the survey. That was the number that they used.
Right.
And then some of the things that we are going to learn about are that the population really hasn't increased too much. That
some it's holding steady.
Right.
Holding steady.
So the population is holding steady.
Okay.
So in 2013, there was like 2.4% of the United States was Jewish, and in and now 2.2%, and now we're at or. Now we're at 2.4%. So let
right,
me clarify
so
that. The size of the Jewish population is fairly stable. Right now, it's at 2.4% of U.S. adults. Approximately 7.5 million people in the United States are Jewish.
Right.
5.8 million adults and 1.8 million children. And in 2013, it was 6.7. So we're about the same.
Okay. So let's clarify that a little bit. The population of the United States is 310 or 325 million.
I couldn't tell you that.
Okay, but I think it's based on that. I think the United States is up to like 325 million.
Okay.
So times 2.2 or 2.4% will get you 7.5 million.
And the other this is the second finding,
right.
is like the U.S. overall U.S. population, Jews appear to be growing more racially and ethnically diverse.
Okay.
So 92% of us say that we are non-white Hispanic. Which is interesting. That means that 8% of us say that we are something other than non-white Hispanic.
Oh, okay, okay.
So we're more diverse than we were before. U.S. Jews are less religious than American adults overall. Jews are 12% of us say that we're religious.
Right, right, right.
And nationwide, 27% say they're religious. 26% of us believe in God. I believe it's time to go to the survey.
All right.
Welcome, Mr. Alan Cooperman. He is the Director of Religion Research at the Pew Research Center. So welcome, Mr. Cooperman.
Hi, thank you very much.
It's a big honor for us to have you. And both Ted and I have done a lot of reading about the Pew Research for American Jews in 2021. And, you know, just curiously, was this... How did you, when you were a young boy, what did you want to be when you grew up? Did you want
to? I wanted to be a baseball player.
Yeah, sure. There was a time when I wanted to be a baseball player, of course. Of course, I fantasized. I was a Washington Senators fan, as a matter of fact, back when there was a team. That shows you what happened to my baseball fandom. The team I loved disappeared, became a, anyway. There was a time in my life when I wanted to be a fiction writer. I thought I might want to write short stories or novels. But sometime in my college years, I really got hooked on journalism, and it became my goal to be a foreign correspondent. And in particular, those were Cold War years, and I spent a lot of time learning Russian and studying the former Soviet Union, and it was my goal to be a foreign correspondent in Moscow.
Huh.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
So where did you grow up at?
Well, I was born in Maryland, in the greater Washington area, and I grew up in western Massachusetts in the Berkshire Mountains.
Very nice, very nice.
Yeah, it is a beautiful, beautiful part of the world. And by the way, religiously, I don't think I know for sure, I didn't realize this at the time, but this little tiny town where I grew up was the home at one time or another of two of America's greatest theologians, both Jonathan Edwards and Reinhold Niebuhr lived in the little town of Stockbridge where I grew up.
Huh. And then one other question about you personally. So what motivated you to start working into the religion and religious studies in your research and your journalism?
You know, Julie, that's a funny question. As I think back on it, the key probably was that I had no interest in professional study of religion when I was a young person. I probably would have ranked it, if you'd given me a list of 20 things that I might end up doing, it would have been somewhere close to the bottom. Maybe not the very bottom, but somewhere close. It's just something that developed over time, in part because of the years I spent as a foreign correspondent. I spent most of a decade, eight years overseas, six of them in the former Soviet Union and in Russia right after the Soviet Union collapsed. And then a couple of years in the Middle East. And in both of those places, without kind of intending to write about religion, I ended up writing quite a bit about religion. In the former Soviet Union, because of the revival, the reemergence of religion after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and in those final years of glasnost and perestroika. And then, obviously, in the Middle East, religion is an omnipresent force. And I was based in Jerusalem for a few years, but I also covered the Arab world and Iran. I was in Iran and Iraq and Lebanon, Egypt, and quite a few of those places. And religion was just a very important thing there in every respect. And
right.
I ended up writing a lot about it. Not usually as religion just all by itself, but as religion and politics and society. And when I came back and ultimately ended up as foreign editor of U.S. News and World Report, that was the period in which what has become known as Islamic terrorism was on the rise, first with the East Africa bombings and the bombing of the coal and so on. And then I went to the Washington Post and I was the national security editor. And again, you know, even though my real interest was in national security and not in religion, religion kept raising its head in one way or another, with 9/11, for example, which I was, you know, one of the editors responsible for the Post coverage of 9/11 and the months thereafter, and had a big team of reporters who worked on it and who won the Pulitzer Prize for the coverage.
Wow.
And so it was a lot of, I didn't win a Pulitzer Prize because I was just an editor, but, you know, religion kept coming up and again and again. And so when I went back ultimately to reporting after a stint as editing, so it's pretty common to go back and forth between editing and reporting. When I went back to reporting, had conversations with my editors and, decided that I would take a shot at being the national religion writer for the Post, which is really a religion and politics beat. And so I did that for several years and I loved it. And then later on, when I left the Washington Post, I came to the Pew Research Center. That's about a dozen years ago. So that's the story.
Where is the Pew Research Center located?
So we're in downtown Washington, D.C. As I like to say, if the big one hits, if the atomic bomb drops on Washington, D.C., we will not suffer. We will be instantly evaporated.
Yes.
Yeah, we're about six blocks away from the White House.
Wow. Okay. So let's talk about this Pew Research study. Yep. We did a little bit of the background. I talked about the number of people that were interviewed and just a few of the first 2 points of the 10 key findings. But how and why? What was the impetus for the 2013 and now the 2020? What was the impetus? What was said to say this is something we need to be doing? Or was it that the Jewish Federations of North America contacted you and the Neubauer Foundation?
Right.
So what was the impetus of this study?
Well, first of all, just to start with that last bit, Julie, nobody contacted us and came to us to ask us to do a survey in that sense, because we don't do surveys by commission. But, you know, the area, the group, the team of researchers, about 20, 25 people that I work with, we study religion in the United States and around the world. And a lot of that involves studying the entire public in the United States or the entire population of various countries or various regions. But we also, of course, do what we think of as deeper dives into smaller religious groups. And so over the years, we have done three surveys of American Muslims focusing in on Muslims. We've done a survey of Mormons. We've done a survey of evangelical leaders around the world. We've done surveys of Asian Americans and their religious beliefs and practices in the United States, and of Black Americans and their religious practices and beliefs and viewpoints in the United States, and also of Latinos and religion. We've done a few of those over the years. So we've done a bunch of these studies. And what happened in approximately 2012 is that it became public that the Jewish Federation system, which you might think of as kind of the organized Jewish community, decided not to conduct another decennial study of American Jews, as had been done in 1990 and in 2001. So you would have thought there would be another one in 2010 or 2011, but it didn't happen, and ultimately they decided not to do it. And actually, we learned about that from Jane Eisner, the editor of the Foreword, and Jane suggested that we should think about it. And so Jane was not commissioning it or coming on behalf of anybody. She came to me, we had lunch one day, and she said, you know, we as someone who writes about American Jews every single day, we're desperately in need of data on American Jews, and the organized Jewish community isn't going to do another study. And would Pew Research Center think about doing such a study? And so that got us going. Frankly, I had not realized that a formal decision had been made by JFNA not to do another study. So we began thinking about it, and we took our time. It's a very complicated subject. There has been a lot of research done on American Jews. It's also a very expensive thing to do well. So some of my colleagues, particularly a guy named Greg Smith, Dr. Smith is the associate director for religion research and really the director of our domestic surveys. Greg and I started going to conferences, reading the academic literature, meeting with people, thinking about it. Ultimately, what we did was we wrote a prospectus. We wrote a three-pager saying what we wanted to do, and we took that to the Neubauer Family Foundation and to the Pew Charitable Trust and asked if they would support it. And they did, and they provided us with, it's a lot of money then, and a lot of money back in 2020 as well to do it again. So that's kind of how it came about. The main research question that we had in that prospectus and still, the foundational question is, what does it mean to be Jewish in America today, in 2013 or in 2020? What does that mean to American Jews? Right. What is being Jewish? And that question is not a simple question, and it kind of in turn leads to all the other questions. Well, so how do people do Jewish things? What Jewish things do they do? How much relative importance does being Jewish have in people's lives? What are the different types of Jewishness among Jews? What's the diversity or the cleavages or the groupings within American Judaism, both the institutional ones and other kinds that might arise from a survey? So that's kind of what we did, and it was a lot of fun in 2013, and when we went to do it a second time, we thought it would be easier, to do it a second time. But in a lot of ways, it actually wasn't easier.
Right, you had a little bit more stresses on there.
Well, Mike, one question is, how much does it cost to do a the study, and how much did the survey cost to do?
I hate to sound coy about this, but it's the Pew Research Center's policy not to publicly discuss the cost of our surveys.
Okay.
And remember, we don't charge anybody anything. We don't We don't take any commercial work. We don't have any clients. We don't have any advertisers. We're all foundation supported and nonprofit organization. And surveys, the biggest cost in a survey like this is not our staff. It's the data collection, and that money goes to a vendor. We typically on these things will put out a request for proposals, and we'll have various of the top flight, what they're called, is survey field houses, submit competitive bids, and there's a competitive aspect to this. So there's proprietary cost structures involved in what it costs, but here's what I can say, because I want to be entirely coy. If you were to go to anybody who's familiar with survey research and give them basically the size and parameters of this survey and say, what does a survey like this cost? They will immediately tell you that you're talking about millions of dollars.
Right, right.
So I just want to go over a few things. Right. So the Pew Charitable Foundation and the Pew Research Center. So the Pew Research Center is a 501c3.
Right.
And how they describe themselves is who we are. They are a nonprofit fact tank that informs the public about the issues, attitudes, trends shaping the world. They are a nonpartisan, non-advocacy, meaning they do not take policy positions or make recommendations. They are a subsidy of the Pew Charitable Trust, as we've talked about a number of times, which is their primary funder. They partner strategically with philanthropists and institutional funders who share their commitment to the impartial research and data that drive discussion.
Right.
And what they do is they generate a foundation of facts to enrich public dialogue and support sound decision making. And they conduct public opinion polling, demographic research, content analysis, and data driven social science research. And on top of all that, all the information that they have is free on their website. So we want to let people know, if they want to read the entire 284 pages, it's on their website on a PDF. There's also the 10 findings on there that they can find.
All right, so,
all the facts and all the statistics on how they did it.
So do we want to start getting into, let's start getting into some of the
questions.
Yes, go ahead.
So, you know, one of the things that I was a little bit shocked about was that I was actually kind of disappointed to read this, that 9% of the Reform, those Jews who identify themselves as Reform, do not feel any connection to the Orthodox, and it's the exact same on the opposite. Of the Orthodox, only 9% of them feel any affiliation towards the Reform.
There is a big chasm or schism between the sects.
But I was pleasantly surprised to see that everybody feels a connection to Israel. So I thought that was a very interesting statistic. And I liked the way that the Pew Research really divided up the different types of Jews. Could you discuss, I tried to do a little bit, but I'm going to let you, Mr. Cooperman, discuss what nones are, that the N-O-N-E-S, the Jews who identify themselves as Jewish, but they don't have a religion.
And then I'll get back to that issue about how much Jews feel they have in common with other kinds of Jews and with Jews in Israel and so on, and maybe slightly restate those findings. Typically in surveys, both the Pew Research Center surveys, but also everybody else's surveys, the surveys that Gallup does, or the American National Election Series surveys, or the General Social Survey, they generally define people's religion, and they define religious groups on the basis of how people answer a question about their religion. Just kind of makes sense, right? So Jews would be people who say, when you ask them what their religion is, say they're Jewish. And in most surveys, that's the whole definition of who counts as Jewish.
And they just leave it at that. Yeah, that's like, they don't go beyond that.
Most surveys leave it at that. So that's it. And in exit polls, for example, you want to know how people voted? So they ask people coming out of the polls. We don't do this, but others do. How did you vote? And they ask them what their religion is. And then they'll say, so evangelical Protestants voted this way. Catholics voted this way. Jews voted this way. And Jews, in that case, is people who said, when they were asked, what's their religion? Jewish. And that's it. Now, in a survey like this, we attempt to do something more difficult and broader, and that is to take a much broader definition of who is a Jew. It's a sort of classic question in Jewish studies: who is a Jew? And we tried it to take really kind of the broadest possible definition of that, and then we also need to have a somewhat narrower definition, kind of for analytical and reporting purposes. But we also preserve the ability for different people to have different answers to that question. So, how do we do that? We ask people not just what is their present religion, but we also ask a couple of other questions, sort of basic, what you might think of as screening questions. And one of them is, do they have a Jewish parent? Not two Jewish parents, and not just a Jewish mother, but a Jewish parent. We also find out later in the survey, we ask them, is it your mother, your father, both? But you have a Jewish parent, or were you raised Jewish? Because some people don't have a biological mother or father is Jewish, but they were adopted by a Jewish family or raised by a Jewish family or raised by a Jewish grandparent or whatever. So do you have a Jewish mother or a Jewish father, or were you raised Jewish? That's one additional question. And anybody who says yes to that is also gets the survey. And then a third question that we use is a broad screen. Do you, aside from religion, no matter whatever you say your religion is, aside from that, do you consider yourself Jewish for any other reason, such as culturally or ethnically or because of your family background? And then anybody who says yes to that also gets swept into the sort of umbrella of people who might possibly be considered Jewish in one of these ways, either because it's their religion, or because aside from religion, they think of themselves as Jewish in any way. Maybe they're married to a Jewish person. Maybe their child married a Jewish person. Maybe their mother or father remarried and married a Jewish person, or whatever the reason is. Or do they themselves have Jewish ancestry? So all these things get brought in. Then for analytical purposes, when we're then trying to present a report to the American public and say, here's what Jews think, we take a somewhat narrower definition because, among other things, I think it could be very misleading if we say, here's what Jews say about this, here's what they think about that, here's how they practice. If we incorporate in that people who say their religion is Christian, for example, but who had a Jewish parent or whatever, but if they say their religion is Christian, or they say their religion is Muslim, but they feel that they're Jewish aside from religion, maybe they have some Jewish ancestry or whatever, they're in the survey, but we don't count them in the main group of people that we call Jews. So when you read the statistics, here's what Jews say about this, here's what Jews say about that, that group is narrower. That group consists of the people who say one of two things: either that their religion is Jewish, and then it doesn't matter how religious they are, how observant they are, whatever, just they said their religion is Jewish, and we'll call that group Jews by religion. And then there's another broad group, and that's the people who say they have at least one Jewish parent or were raised Jewish. They don't have to have two, but they have to have at least one Jewish parent or have been raised Jewish, and they say they have no religion. That is, when you ask them what their religion is, they say they're atheist or agnostic or just nothing in particular.
Right.
But they also do tell us that they consider themselves Jewish in some other way. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter what that other way is, but they consider themselves Jewish. So that other group we call Jews of no religion. And we didn't invent that term.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but you have that in every religion. So you've been using nones every religion too.
Well, there's a little bit different. It's a little bit different, Julie, for some other religions, because there is a broad category of nones that we do use, and actually, we generally prefer to use the term unaffiliated. And nones are people who don't identify with any religion in the United States. So if you give people a list of possibilities and you say, are you Christian, or actually you might say, are you Protestant, Catholic, right, Orthodox, as in Greek and Russian Orthodox, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, atheist, agnostic,
There's a ton.
Something else or nothing in particular. This group of people who say that they're atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular, that they get classified as kind of none of the above. And different surveys will use different terms, but this group of people who say they have no religion, they don't identify with any religion, that's a big and growing group in American life. Yep. It doesn't mean that that group of people has no religious beliefs or practices. Some of them do go to church. Many of them do believe in God. Some of them do pray and so on, but they don't identify with any organized religious group. Yes, there's the nuns. And then among Jews, there's this kind of parallel group, which is this group of Jews of no religion. But it's not exact. Other religious groups don't exactly have the same thing, because if you think about it, it's pretty weird to think of somebody being sort of Methodist aside from religion.
All right, so
you could be a United Methodist, or you could be a Baptist, but can you be a Baptist aside from religion? That's a little weird. But Jewishness is a matter of peoplehood as well as religion.
We're a tribe and we're a culture, in addition to also having a religion.
Exactly. So that's why people can leave, cannot identify with the religion, but still be Jewish. But we do impose this analytical rule, which others can disagree with. And it's preserved in the data, the ability to take a different definition. But we do say, if you identify with any other religion, then we're not going to count you in our main Jewish category. Yeah. So again, if you say you're a Muslim or a Christian or a Wiccan or a Hindu or a Buddhist, and you consider yourself Jewish in some other way, we say that's great. We want to ask you a lot of questions. We have you in our data set, but we're not going to count you in the population that we're calling Jewish, and you're not going to be considered in the statistics to say, here's what American Jews think about this, that, and the other thing. Because I think for a lot of the public, that would just be very confusing.
Yes. So
there are a lot of Christians in the United States who have some Jewish ancestry and who say there's probably well over a million people in that category.
And we don't learn that now through the DNA. And then you wanted to clarify the thing that I said I was a little disturbed to find out.
So this is a question where we ask people how much they have in common. We ask Jews how much they have in common with various other kinds of Jews. And you mentioned the 9%. And so the options where you could say you have a lot in common, some in common, not much in common, or nothing at all in common. And we ask this of various people so we can analyze it. What share of Reform Jews say they have a lot in common with Orthodox Jews? And it's 9% of Reform Jews who say they have a lot in common with Orthodox Jews. And we ask Orthodox Jews how much they have in common with Reform Jews, and 9% of Orthodox Jews say they have a lot in common with Reform Jews. But I think the other part of the equation that you were getting at, and properly so, is that a majority of Reform Jews, 60%, said they had not much or nothing at all in common with Orthodox Jews.
Which I find that upsetting, because we're all Jews.
About half of Orthodox Jews, 48% of Orthodox Jews, said they had not much or nothing at all in common with Reform Jews. Both groups had a fair amount in common with conservative Jews and vice versa.
Right.
And all these groups, as you said, indicated a fair amount of commonality, not total, but a fair amount of commonality with Jews in Israel. And in fact, both Orthodox Jews and Reform Jews feel they have more in common with Jews in Israel than they do with each other. So I think that is an interesting finding. I would, if you're trying to understand it, one thing to bear in mind is that this survey in 2020 was conducted over a period of several months, but those months were months that coincided with the presidential election campaign.
Right. I noticed there was a lot in there. Yeah, there's a lot about, you had a lot of questions relating to Trump, which will they be, when you do your next one, will those, we'll have to, I guess you'll have to have a substitute for the Trump questions.
No, because you don't know what's going to happen in 4 years.
So obviously, I don't mean to get you in the middle of this war here, but Ted and I are on opposite poles in that way. So just wanted to be aware of that.
In 2013, we had some questions about Obama. More this time because Trump, led a vigorous policy toward Israel and had Jews, his immediate family, and was kind of a divisive figure in American Judaism, as you can see in the polls.
Also at the White House, the first time in the history of America that they had a kosher kitchen at the White House. Kosher kitchen.
Okay, well, Ted, I don't want to... But they have koshered the kitchen for other events, because when I went to the White House, the kitchen had
been... Koshered it, Ted.
So,
but they have an actual kosher kitchen.
We don't want him
there.
Involved in our
we
personal...
We don't want to get him into those. Anyway,
in our personal
we do wanna...
disputes between...
So
I got to
get out of your kitchen, Ted and Julie, out of the squabbling in your kitchen, delightful as it is. I'll just get back to this question about how much Orthodox... So what I'm trying to say is... One reason why in 2020, when we asked this question, Orthodox Jews might have said they have not much in common with Reformed Jews and vice versa is because both groups were pretty aware, I think, pretty broadly aware, this is anecdotal, I think, of where the other stood on politics.
Right.
And we can see in the survey that they're kind of like polar opposite.
Yeah.
Correct.
Near opposite.
And that result didn't shock me at all.
Well,
as in 75% of the Orthodox
are Republican.
Republican or lean Republican and overwhelmingly supportive of Trump, and 71%
of Americans, Jews, are Democrats.
Yeah, and among the, so if you take just the Reform, then it's higher than that.
Right.
76% of Reform Jews are Democratic, or were as of the time of the survey, and very, very opposed to Trump or gave Trump very negative ratings in the survey. So part of it may have been the political backdrop, but I'm not sure that that's all of it. And I think one of the things that comes out of this survey is that while the rest of the world, the non-Jewish world, may think of Jews as monolithic in some way, American Jews, I think themselves, are very aware that the population is not monolithic. There are some sources of unity for sure, and we talk about that in the report. But there are also some sources potentially of cleavage, one of those has to do with attitudes towards Israel. Another one has to do with partisanship. Another one has to do with kind of really very different worldviews. Orthodox Jews have very different worldviews. You can see this throughout the survey. From Reform Jews and Jews, maybe Jews in general. So that's, some questions in the survey about where people find meaning and purpose in their lives, meaning and fulfillment, I should say, rather than meaning and purpose, meaning and fulfillment. And the way Orthodox Jews answer those questions is very different from the way Jews as a whole answer those questions.
So there are these 10 key findings, and I've already gone through the first couple of them, and we want people to know that they can find those 10 key findings on your Pew website. And some of the other things that I thought were interesting is that all Jews seem to like Jewish food, that young Jews and old Jews participate at the same rate. And I was thinking, well, young Jews are looking for friends and they're starting out in their career and they're maybe looking for spouses, and old Jews have a lot more time. So maybe that's why that's going on. I also saw that...
Let me stop you there, Julie. Another possibility is that the younger Jewish population contains like two groups in larger proportions than the older proportion.
Notice that as well. Yes,
and
explain
one
that.
Of those is the Orthodox. So among younger Jews, there are more Jews who are Orthodox, and in fact, more who are what is sometimes called ultra-Orthodox or Haredi.
Right.
And there are also more Jews who are at the kind of the low end of the religiosity spectrum. What I mean by that is people who don't identify with the Jewish religion but are culturally or ethnically Jewish, and people who don't identify with any particular branch or stream of American Judaism. And those people tend to be less religious, and they also tend to be less active in all the sort of cultural Jewish activities, like going to Jewish film festivals or celebrating.
They just haven't tasted halabah yet.
But see, the thing, there, on one, two, three, four, five, number, is it seven?
Mm-hmm.
Is read Jewish news.
Yes.
Which means they read Jewish newspapers like the American Israelite.
Correct.
And they read us online at our website and they listen to our podcast.
Right.
So, yeah, but my point is that the folks at the low end of the religious spectrum also do those things, including reading Jewish news at lower rates than the people who are at the high end of the spectrum.
Right.
And if you look at the age groups, the interesting thing is that younger Jews have more of sort of both of those poles. They've got more of the people 41. Who are both highly traditionally religious and highly engaged in all kind of aspects of Jewish life on average.
Right.
But they also have this big chunk of people who are pretty non-religious.
41%.
Comparatively,
I don't want to exaggerate this because it's not that they have no connections, but they are much lower in their levels of connections. They're lower in their levels of feelings of belonging, and they're lower in their levels of when we ask them, how often do you do these various things? And not all these things are religious things. We ask how often people visit Jewish sites, historical sites, when they travel. How often they read Jewish literature, biography, follow Jewish news, listen to Israeli music, those sorts of things. So there's a bunch of things in there that aren't necessarily religious. And we do this analysis, and it's presented in the report, and you can see people who are at the low end of the religiosity spectrum, people who are not traditionally religious, people who don't go to synagogues, they do some of these things, but they do them at lower rates.
Well, they forgot the 11th question, though. The 11th question is, how often do you call your mother?
How often
do you call your mother and tell her you love her?
And how many times does she call you during the day?
We'll have to say that.
That should be in there, too. Yes, yes, yes.
I will not disagree with you.
So, we want to tell people again that they need to go to your website to get it, especially to study the one chart where you talk about that in the age group of 18 to 29 of the Orthodox, 17% are young people, 18 to 39, but also of the non-religious.
17% of the young people are Orthodox. And that's much higher. If you look at people over the age of 65, it's just 3% who are Orthodox.
So that's,
if you look at Jews who are ages 18 to 29, it's 17% who are Orthodox. And most of that 17% are ultra-Orthodox. So the thing that seems to be going on, Julie, is that there's growth at what you might think of as polar ends.
Right.
Of a kind of traditional Jewish spectrum.
Right.
But the growth is happening for different reasons. So the reason the Orthodox are growing as a share is not because people are turning Orthodox, not because people who are raised as Reform Jews are becoming Orthodox. Quite the contrary.
It's because they're more prolific.
Because of birth rate
and early marriages and
less intermarriage.
Yeah, right.
The less intermarriage is an interesting question. I'm going to leave that aside for a second. But the Orthodox get married at higher rates. They marry early, they start their families early, and they have more children. So basically, you get sort of three generations compressed into the time that, say, Reform Jews would have two generations. You get almost three generations of Orthodox.
And bigger
families.
Yep.
So it's what demographers would call natural increase. And again, I'm just trying to emphasize it isn't just a matter of fertility rates. It's a combination of what demographers would call fertility and fertility timing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's driving the Orthodox. Now, we have not everybody who's born into an Orthodox family stays Orthodox. And in fact, quite a few people over a period of time have left Orthodoxy. And we can measure that because we ask people in what stream of Judaism where they raised, and we ask them what they are now. And I can tell you that the ratio is 3 to 1 among Orthodox leading to coming. So what I mean by that is that for every three people who were raised as Orthodox and left and are no longer Orthodox. Maybe they're conservative, maybe they're Reform, maybe right. they're not being Pacific. But for every three of those, there's just one who was not raised Orthodox who has become Orthodox.
That's me.
So the Orthodox are actually, you know, they're a net loser through this kind of internal switching within Judaism. But they're growing nonetheless by generation
right.
because of the high birth rates and fertility timing. At the other end of the spectrum, among the Jews of no religion, or you can define it in various groups, but various ways, but among the people who are not very religious and not so engaged in Jewish life, that group is growing, but not because of fertility. It's growing for totally different reasons. It's growing through this religious switching. Mm-hmm. It's growing for it's growing in the opposite way
right.
because many people who were raised as conservative Jews have become Reform Jews, and many people raised as Reform Jews enter this group of people who consider themselves just Jewish aside from religion.
Right.
So different reasons for the growth, but both ends are growing. And then sort of the traditionally dominant streams of American Judaism, which are still very large.
Yeah.
The conservative movement and the Reform movement, which together, so Reform is about 37%, conservative is about 17%. So together, they're an actual majority of all American Jews, 54%.
Right.
So let's
right.
not forget that. These
right.
are big, big institutional allegiances. But those groups are much smaller in the younger generation than they are in the older generation.
Yes.
So if you look at this just by age group, then you would say the pattern appears to be that together Reform and especially conservative Jews are kind of losing, if you think of it this way, market share by age category, while
right.
Orthodox are gaining, and at the opposite end, the people who don't identify with any stream
mm-hmm.
are also gaining.
Well,
so sort of the middle, if you will, the way some sociologists would put it, and others will argue with this, that something the middle is shrinking.
All right, so we could go on, and
this is unbelievable.
It's fantastic.
I could keep talking to you all
right,
day.
Right, right. It would take hours and hours and hours, but we're kind of reaching our time limit on the show.
And I do want to really thank you for all of your time. I had a couple more questions I want to ask you. I maybe will email them through
yeah.
Anna Schiller.
Yeah.
I really appreciate her connecting us up with you and the amount of information you've shared
right.
with
us. Right, he's just a fountain of information here today.
But also, we want to remind everyone they can go on the website and
right.
see.
Go to Pew Research.
Pew Research.
Okay.
And also, you can find all of Mr. Cooperman's articles. He's written a number of ones on different religions if
okay.
you want to read about the other religions, which I find just as fascinating. And I just think that this is and it's a wonderful gift that Pew Research has given to everyone
right.
who wants to study
right.
these things. It's an amazing amount of information. Everything's in there, all their statistics, how they did it. So, Mr. Cooperman, we can't thank you enough. This has been a big
Well, honor. You're very kind. Thank you so much.
You're
I've
like
enjoyed
a rock
that.
Star. Do you realize that you're like a rock star?
You are. He
you're
is.
A celebrity to us.
My mother is no longer around, so you have to call my wife and tell my wife.
Okay, well, we'll send you the
you
link.
Tell my
to the
wife
book.
I'm a rock star.
You are a rock star. You are a celebrity in our book. Thank you very much.
You're very sweet. Thank you so much. And keep on reading, folks, The American Israelite.
Thank you.
Fantastic. All right. Thank
bye
you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. So we want to thank Alan Cooperman from the Pew Research Study.
That's amazing. It was amazing.
You know, you could talk to him for like 3 or 4 hours at least.
We need him at a dinner party because we were actually discussing the Pew Research this weekend with a number of people because I was so fascinated by
it. Well, I've talked when I go to synagogue, everybody wants to bring it up. I had people at the synagogue suggesting me, you know, you should read this article. And I think what we should point out is, the stuff that you're reading is people that are interpreting what they've read and then kind of giving their opinion on it versus this was from the, right from the horse's mouth.
Right. So you there right actually is a video from the, you can go on the Jewish Federations of North America. Have an hour and 15-minute video. Our Carol watched it. I watched it, and it's still online. You can watch it.
Okay.
Where you've got some
just
rabbis.
Just the facts.
Well, that's not the facts. That's actually opinions from rabbis and community leaders.
Okay.
So that's a different version where they're analyzing and talking about it. But with us, it was just the facts, which I loved, and getting to know Mr. Cooperman, it's wonderful.
Yeah, he's a wealth of information. So we want to start with the news, and we'd only have so much time, so we're just going to really go through it really quickly.
So you've got a memoriam for Henry Hirsch.
Henry Hirsch was Mr. Hirsch, who I knew, his son. I grew up with Henry Hirsch III, who now goes by the name of Hank. Grew up in Cincinnati with him, and I used to have sleepovers with him, so that's kind of a shout-out to my buddy Hank Hirsch. His father was a well-known attorney in Cincinnati, went to Princeton University and Yale Law School, moved to Cincinnati to get a job at Paxton Cizagood, which then merged into Thompson and Hine, which is still around today. He was a one of the youngest presidents of Rockdale Temple in its history. This is back in the 60s, and he was a major contributor. Then they moved out to, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce it, it's Healdsburg, California, which is in Sonoma County, where my cousin lives in Petaluma.
Oh, we go over Petaluma again.
Petaluma! Anyway. Shout out to Petaluma. And so they
may his memory be for a blessing.
Yes. Henry Hirsch was a well-known Cincinnatian and
a big contributor to our community and other communities.
Truly a mensch of a man.
So on page 3, we have Under the Tent, which the Israelite is also sponsoring, and there's a wonderful article about Rockdale Welcomes Executive Director David Solomon. A little bit of story here. David Solomon and Rabbi Meredith Gahan met at the JCC when we were all taking a baby, you know, mommy and me class. Okay. I was in there with my Lauren Brooke, and they met at Playgroup.
Are we going to keep that in there?
Yes. Okay. And then in the meantime, they met at Playgroup, so I think it's wonderful that they went from Playgroup to working together professionally.
I wanted to say one thing about this. So under this Sunday coming up, which is Sunday the 13th, at 2:30, the Federation and many other organizations are having a rally for Israel, about Israel, at the JCC. I will be there. There will probably be thousands of people there. So if you're interested, come to the rally.
And referring back to the Pew Research, there's 5% of people in recent history who feel that they aren't attending some events that are Jewish because of their fear of security. I can guarantee you that Cincinnati has an amazing security system for their Jewish population. So don't go there in fear. Right. Don't stay home out of fear.
Right.
Go there and know that you will be very secure. So on page 5, we've got
JCRC.
The crisis of extremism. JCRC is holding their annual meeting.
And that's coming up on Tuesday, June 29th at 7 p.m. That's virtual. So go to JCRC Cincinnati and sign up to go to the annual meeting.
So on page 7, we've got to do some clarification here. There's an article that says, as Hebrew-Israeli student-athlete in Ohio forced to eat pork. So first of all, we're going to clarify the headline should read Hebrew-Israelite, and that is a term for black Hebrew Israelites. And this was I went through all a Google search. Everybody used the term Hebrew Israelite because this is a denomination of people that come out of Africa, or they are African Americans, and therefore that's why this is not a young man who came out of Israel. He is not technically a Jewish man. So you need to go through and understand that black Hebrew Israelites are a group of people that believe they are the original Hebrew Israelites out of Israel.
Okay, so in Israeli news, now the government that's trying to form with Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid. Today is Wednesday, and right now we're at about, 2 o'clock or so?
Yeah.
And they have until midnight tonight Israel time. So it's, 7-8 hours ahead of us? So they've got a couple hours to form this government, and then we should know in a couple hours whether or not they form the government. If they didn't form the government, then Netanyahu will still remain in power. And then he's got, I guess, they're going to have another election. They'll have to have another election.
And I want you to read near the end, I'd say on the fourth column, there's just one funny thing. It says that the government will not include any Haredi or ultra-Orthodox parties, but it will still be mostly Ashkenazi and male. And the writer, Benjamin Sales, writes, There are a lot of ways Israel's incoming government will be different. There are also plenty of ways it will be the same. Like every prime minister not named Golda Meir, the next leader of Israel will be an Ashkenazi Jewish man. So I thought that was very funny.
All right. So starting on page 10, we have our twice annual auto guide with many advertisers and many dealerships. And please go support them and tell them that, you know, you support them because they support the American Israelite. Many of your favorite cars are in there this week. So, and guys love reading about cars. We like cars. We're car
they
guys.
They rev their motors that way.
Yeah, we then, rev our
the Hearing, Speech, and Deaf Center is having a gala September 23rd.
Right.
It's the 5th annual Laura and Richard Kretschmer Service Award Gala honoring Donna Mayerson,
right,
PhD.
That's coming up September 23.
Yep.
Moving right along.
So we are up to the Today in Israel News. I want you to know that on today, June 17th, 1939, the St. Louis returns to Europe. So that was the ship that came here trying to get into here and into Cuba and to another other, and it was turned away. That's the ship that was turned away. And of the 938 passengers, 254 of them were eventually killed in the Holocaust because they were turned away. So now we are on page 18 from the pages.
Well, I don't know if we've got enough time to do the whole thing.
No.
So you want to just to page, we'll skip, there's Samuel Brule again, there's also
the ladies' column is very funny. I think you should look at the ladies' column because if you read it and think about it, it's actually written sort of in a sexy way.
Oh, and I've got some good news. So I've talked to Carol and to Melissa, and so one of Pam Sakes' suggestion was that we have once a month the center pages of the paper have nothing but ads from all these dates from behind, you know, back then. And we'll have like three pages of ads like, you know, 1875. They're fascinating.
They're wonderful.
They're really fascinating. We love them. And then you wanted to do 50 years ago.
So
and then
50
I've got another 50 years ago.
Yeah, 50 years ago, Mr. and Mrs. H. Lewis Serkin, Mary Lee Schwazen, 2617 LaSanneville Road. And they told me it was actually 2619 LaSanneville Road. Announced the birth of a daughter, Jennifer Ann, Wednesday, June 2nd. The infant has a sister, Tammy Lynn, and she also has another sister that was born later on, Elizabeth. So Jennifer Ann was a graduate of Walnut Hills High School and the University of Illinois, my alma mater. She had a BA in literature, and then she
was... What was the mascot to the Illini?
Chief Illini Wek.
What the heck is... What is an Illini?
It's an Indian tribe. When he used to come out and dance, I got the chills. And then he does this thing with his arm where he makes the eye. Oh, my God, I was just in heaven.
Isn't that the same thing they sing when you walk into Nordstrom's?
Yes. Hallelujah. So anyway, she got a master's in Boston at Boston College in education, and she became a teacher for 11 years in Skokie, Illinois. She's married to Richard Meldman, and they eventually moved to Indianapolis and had two daughters, Rachel, who's graduating from the 8th grade, and Emily, who's 12. They now live in Milwaukee, and Mary Lee says it's very interesting because her parents came from Milwaukee, which I think it's very cute.
Went back to Milwaukee.
Now the family's going back to Milwaukee.
That's strange.
And anyway, and her younger sister, Elizabeth, is a professor at Mount St. Joe, and her other sister, Tammy, is an attorney in Chicago. So that's a lovely story. There's a bunch of other good stories this week in from the pages.
Well, I wanted to do, from 50 years ago, Mr. and Mrs. Jack Shartok, 3520 Longmeadow Lane, are pleased to announce the forthcoming bar mitzvah of their son, Lee Robert Shartok, on Saturday, June 26th at 9 a.m. at Adith Israel Synagogue, Ridge and Galbraith Roads. The family, now here, this is the important
part.
Yes. The family cordially invites their relatives and friends to worship with them at the services and to rejoice with them at the Kiddush immediately following services. So I know Lee Shartok. This is actually a shout out to Lee Shartok. I've known Lee since I was in high school with him at Walnut Hills, and I actually see him and talk to him still now. And he used to, his dad had this like a 1969 or whatever black Eldorado. It was an Eldorado, and he would drive us around in this Eldorado. Me and Bill Lazarus would catch a ride with him once in a while from school.
Cool.
And he would drive this. It was barely over the, you know, the steering wheel, driving this big Eldorado. It was like, anyway, those are the good old days. And also, I want one more to one of my good friends, Mrs. Thomas S. Heldman, announced the graduation from scuba diving school of her husband, Tom Heldman, and son, Tim Heldman, on Saturday, June 12th at Newtown Gravel Pit. Andy Heldman and Kenny Heldman, sons and brothers of the graduates, will attend graduation ceremonies to which all relatives and friends are invited. No cards.
So no cards again. I mean, there weren't formal invitations, but I bet there was dessert there.
And that was from June 10, 1971.
So on 10 years ago, we ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, now you can run away with the circus without ever leaving Cincinnati with Shalom Families. They present Circus Sunday, a free event for families, and Sunday is spelled like the ice cream sundae. A free event for families in the Jewish community with children 10 and under. The biggest show on earth for little ones. This event will allow kids and parents to the chance to experience life under the big tent where they'll soar to great heights on flying trapeze. You get me confused. Heights on the flying trapeze, balance on the tightrope, learn to juggle, stilt walks, spin plates, and just plain clown around on Sunday.
It's really hard to spin a plate on it one is. Of those sticks.
But this is one of Pam's sake's Shalom Family events.
Did a good job with
very
that.
Very nice.
Still. All right, I think we're probably at, there is an ad at the back page for...
I want to add that Gail, Pam, and I went to lunch and talked about you the entire time.
Oh, God. How I was selling her pot at French Park. Hey, that never happened. All right, so anyway, here is a joke. Now,
we didn't do the obituaries, Ted.
Oh, we have to do obituaries.
Yes, so we have David Dushman, the last surviving Auschwitz liberator, dies at 98.
Yes.
Martin Rubin, age 94, June 7th, 2021, the 27th of Sivan, 5781.
Barry Goodman, age 78, June 2nd, 2021, 22 Sivan, 5781.
Elaine Cohn Brown, knee Cohn, age 89, June 1st, 2021, 21st of Sivan, 5781. May their memories be for a blessing. And now you can do the joke of the week.
All right. Now, I'm just telling you, I'm not that great of a joke meister. So, you know, people have been complaining about my joke delivery. And I'm just going to tell you that, you know, you get what you pay for. Okay? I'm not getting paid to do this. So, you know. All right, here's the joke, and this is from The Best of American Jewish Humor by Henry D. Spaulding. My grandmother didn't understand English too well, explained the young fellow, but what she heard good. I recall the time I went to meet her at the bus stop. To my surprise, I saw her get off the bus backward. So I asked her the reason. I get off backwards, she explained, because your grandpa once told me that on the New York buses, everyone wants to grab your seat. What the heck does that mean anyway? When are we going to grab your seat? Grabbing your tuchus or they're taking your seat?
She took it the wrong way. She thought that it meant that they were grabbing her tuchus when it was actually they were taking the chair that she was sitting on, that seat. So I do want to compliment the Jewish Cincinnati on the, I think the ad for the Under the Tent on the last page is really, really creative.
Okay.
I would love to have seen that into a poster.
That was Liz Lowry.
That's beautiful work.
And Pam Geller did that with Susan Zimmerman.
And again, you're one of the supporting organizations, which is lovely. Yep. So we want to thank everyone. We want to especially thank Mr. Alan Cooperman.
Yeah.
What an honor for us.
We could talk to him for days and days about this whole
survey. As I said, he'd make
a
great
dinner
party companion.
Yeah, we only had so much time to talk today. It was, you know, we had to squeeze a lot into that time.
And I had a couple of questions. I had some good ideas for future questions. I might email and send those
in. That's fine. Okay.
Anyway, thank you all for listening. Have a good week. Shavua Tov. And we'll see you next week where we have Lee Hamill, who's coming in to discuss Dr. Gordon Block, who had been gone missing during World War II and later came back to Cincinnati and became a prominent physician here, as well as the fact that she's from some of the original Cincinnati families that are buried both in the Walnut Hills and Chestnut Street cemeteries.
All right, so we'll say call it a day. Thanks, everyone,
Thank you.
We'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.